Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, the 18th of March, 2024. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. Here's Carol with our first story.
Thank you, Jeff. On the front page, hoping for more hoops in the heartland. This is written by Gretchen Teske for the Quad City Times. Thousands of people poured into Vibrant Arena at the Mark this weekend, and it was not for a concert. Moline was hosting Hoops in the Heartland, the Missouri Valley Conference's women's basketball tournament. The tournament has been held in Moline for 9 years, and Visit Quad City's CEO, Dave Harrell, is hoping it stays longer. The contract for the tournament is on a 3-year cycle, he said, and will end this year. Visit Quad Cities has already put out a proposal to renew the contract and is hoping to know the outcome by mid-April. In an email, officials with the MVC said the conference was still working through the process and hoped to have a decision in the spring. 12 teams across 6 states come in for the tournament every year, Harrell said, bringing in just shy of $2 million for the Quad Cities in a single weekend. Schools and their athletes account for about 2,200 hotel rooms throughout the weekend, and an additional 600 are rented by the traveling fans. He said the fans are always going to ebb and flow. It depends on who's hot and where those teams are seated. But you can anticipate several thousand people in the Quad Cities every year for multiple days. While some schools, like Drake and the University of Northern Iowa, are fairly close by, others like Missouri State and Belmont have a drive. Bringing in those outside crowds creates good visibility for the region, he said, and that's another reason to keep the tournament around. Visitors patronize local businesses, but Visit Quad Cities also has invested in local commercials. The tournament has national visibility tied into the championship game, not to mention media coverage with all 12 schools bringing their own staff to write and report on the game. They're all writing about the Quad Cities and writing about hoops in the heartland, so it's a really good value add just in terms of media coverage, Harrell said. On the holistic side of things, having the strategic ability to host a premier women's event in our backyard, and the fact it's the longest-standing neutral site for women's basketball in the country, that's a great differentiator for us. The Quad Cities is one of few communities that have had the honor of hosting, Harrell said, and is hopeful the tournament comes back for another 3 years. What we've done as a community is put our best foot forward, show why we want this event, and it does have a positive turn on investment, he said. Our community embraces it, and we want to deliver the message that we are different. We have done a good job. We have proven we're a great host, and we want you back year after year. Jeff?
Promoting self-confidence and love. Shades of Beauty Summit. Talk career accomplishment and challenges. Dressed head to toe in pink and bright pastels, 5 Quad Cities women talked about their career accomplishments and challenges in a Barbie-themed summit designed to inspire young women at Augustana. Called Shades of Beauty, Sunday's summit marked its 5th year. It was started by Ashley Allen, the director of Augustana College's Office of Student Inclusion and Diversity. The goal was really to provide an event where students felt like they were enough, Allen said. The reason why we bring in women leader speakers, especially in the community of diverse background, that helps students be able to see themselves. This year's speakers were Maria Contreras Huerta, a wealth management banker at U.S. Bank, Renee Gellerman, the president and CEO of United Way Quad Cities, Elizabeth Kantner, a teacher at Longfellow Liberal Arts, Nicole Watterson Lamb, the founder and CEO of Ms. Brimani's Hair and Beauty Supply and the Urban Reserve in Rock Island, and Zhang Sony Yang, the director of Augustana's Office of International Student and Scholar Services. Several of the speakers were also parents and talked about the challenges of balancing a career with expectations for women in taking care of a home and children. I was really intentional about bringing people from the Quad Cities to see that even in their own backyard, there's women doing amazing things, Alan said. And I think it's also important to know that even though you may see a president or a CEO, there's also moms, teachers. It's a celebration of different backgrounds, but also how a woman shows up in their life. Alan said the summit organizers started planning for the event during the summer when the film Barbie appeared on the big lot of buzz. But, she said, researching how Barbie evolved to celebrate all different types and careers of women inspired her and the planners. Nicole Watson Lamb started her business 25 years ago this May as a single mama with bad credit and a dead-end job. But she kept at it, as she told the audience. As she pursued a loan, many told her that she should go to school and get a business degree. But she felt that she could fill a niche for a black-owned beauty supply company. Don't let anyone tell you you can't do something for any reason, Watson Lamb said. Now, she also owns an event venue and has been recognized by the Quad Cities Chamber and the City of Rock Island for her accomplishments. Yang told the audience that as a Hmong American, she often felt she had two different lives that pulled her in different directions, speaking English at school and Hmong at home, for example. Growing up, she said her brothers would participate in after-school activities while she stayed home. She said she questioned her parents about cultural norms and assumptions for a woman's role and pushed to do more out-of-school activities and pursue advanced degrees. Gellerman told the audience to remember to thank themselves and recognize the work they put in for themselves every day. She referenced a recent Emmy acceptance speech by Niecy Nash, in which the actress thanked herself for believing in herself. I've learned that nothing in life is easy, Gellerman said. In fact, the higher the stakes, the bigger the battle. And I think it's important to understand who you're up against and who you're battling. Because you're not battling your classmates, you're not battling your friends, or women or men or your competitors. You're in a battle with yourself. It's you against you. Kantner, answering a question about how to react to changes in plans, said once she became a teacher and graduated with her master's, she then planned to start a family with her husband. But she said she couldn't conceive, so they adopted. And adopted. Now, she said, they're raising two wonderful teenagers. Contreras Huerta told the audience after her second child, she and her husband realized they couldn't afford childcare and one person would have to stay home. She quit her job to stay home with her kids. That lasted about a month, Contreras Huerta said. I couldn't do it. Although I loved spending time with my sons, I didn't feel accomplished. So I started working again, and my husband became a stay-at-home dad. She said it came with some judgment, including from her grandmother, who thought she should be the one at home with the children. While her grandmother's views haven't changed, she has come to respect her decisions, Contreras Huerta said. I refused to be a housewife just because that's how it's supposed to be, Contreras Huerta said. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And the following article, Celebrating Living Well Month, is written by Kristen Bogdanis, who is nutrition and wellness educator for the University of Illinois Extension, serving Henry, Mercer, Rock Island, and Stark counties. If you want more information after hearing this article, information about resources and events, visit extension.illinois.edu/HMRS. And here is what she has to say. Annual campaign aims to promote healthy living. March marks the celebration of Living Well Month, an initiative proudly led by the National Extension Association of Family and Consumer Sciences. This annual campaign aims to promote healthy living and recognizes the vital role played by FCS professionals in educating individuals, families, and communities nationwide. Representing diverse program areas, including nutrition, food safety, family life, and consumers' economics, FCS educators empower people to prioritize well-being. As we embark on Extension Living Well Month, it's a timely invitation to celebrate and prioritize holistic well-being. This month-long observation encourages individuals and communities to focus on living well in every aspect of life, fostering physical, mental, and emotional health. Let's explore the essence of Extension Living Well Month and discover ways to enhance our overall well-being with some practical steps. A holistic approach to living well. First, physical wellness, nourishing the body, mindful choices about nutrition, regular physical activity, and a healthy lifestyle form the foundations of physical wellness. Consider incorporating nutritious meals, staying active, and ensuring adequate sleep to promote optimal physical health. Second, mental and emotional health, cultivating resilience. Integral components of living well, mental and emotional well-being, are supported by extension programs. This month offers an opportunity to explore mindful practices, connect with mental health resources, and prioritize self-care. Third, community engagement, building social connections. Living Well extends to the relationships and communities we build. Extension Living Well Month encourages community engagement and social connections. Participate in local events and community programs and strengthen your social support network for improved quality of life and longevity. Now, armed with knowledge, let's put this into action. Here are five steps to embrace Living Well Month. First, attend extension programs and workshops. Many extension offices offer health-focused programs. Reach out to your local extension office for information on workshops and events in your area. For programs and events in Illinois, visit extension.illinois.edu/HMRS. And for programs and events in Iowa, visit extension.iastate.edu/scott/. Second, explore outdoor activities. Take advantage of warmer weather by engaging in outdoor activities like hiking, gardening, or walks in your favorite natural space. Outdoor time positively impacts well-being and puts the mind at ease. Third, practice mindfulness. Incorporate mindfulness practices into your daily routine through meditation, deep breathing, or mindful walks. These activities enhance mental clarity and reduce stress. Fourth, connect with local resources. Reach out to local community centers, extension offices, and health organizations for information on resources and programs that align with living well principles. Fifth, encourage well-being in your community. Be an advocate for well-being. Share information. Organize wellness events. Or collaborate with local organizations to create a supportive environment for others to live well. Extension Living Well Month serves as a reminder that well-being is interconnected and deserving of international attention. By embracing a holistic approach to living well, we can cultivate a life filled with health, joy, and purpose. Let this month be a catalyst for positive changes that contribute to a well-lived life for yourself and for your community. And again, the article is written by Kristen Bogdanis, nutrition and wellness educator for the University of Illinois Extension, serving Henry, Mercer, Rock Island, and Stark counties. And for more information, visit extension.illinois.edu/HMRS. Thank you. And here is Jeff.
In Illinois state news, two state prisons to be rebuilt. Logan and Stateville Correctional Centers will be rebuilt. Governor J.B. Pritzker's administration on Friday revealed plans to demolish and rebuild two state prisons, including Logan Correctional Center in Lincoln, in a move that officials said would address years of disinvestment in the aging facilities and save the state millions in annual upkeep costs. The roughly $900 million plan, which also entails a temporary closure, tearing down and rebuilding of Stateville Correctional Center in suburban Chicago, is included in Pritzker's fiscal year 2025 capital budget proposal. It's not yet known if Logan would remain open in the interim, with state officials saying that it is still to be worked through with various stakeholders. Also yet to be finalized is the location of the new facility. These investments will allow staff to work in modern and safe facilities, ensure those who are incarcerated can safely serve out their sentences, and save taxpayers hundreds of millions in deferred maintenance costs from years of neglect, Pritzker said in a statement. The announcement, however, was met with serious concern from the labor union that represents prison employees, whose leaders said they were not consulted in the formation of the plan. And it was condemned by Logan County elected officials for injecting a significant degree of uncertainty into the future of one of the county's major employers. We have grave concerns, said Roberta Lynch, executive director of AFSCME Council 31, excuse me, the union that represents nearly 10,000 corrections employees. Closing facilities, even temporarily, would disrupt and potentially destabilize the prison system while bringing upheaval to the lives of affected employees and individuals in custody. Logan County officials, including State Senator Sally Turner and State Representative Bill Hauter, County Board Chair Emily Davenport, and Lincoln Mayor Tracy Welch, in a joint statement, called the announcement both devastating and infuriating. Logan Correctional is an instrumental part of Lincoln and its surrounding communities, the group wrote. It provides more than 500 direct jobs, hundreds more indirect jobs, and immeasurable local economic benefits. We will continue to fight for each and every one of these jobs and ensure our communities get the answers they deserve from the governor's administration. Construction costs for both prison projects are estimated between $805 million to $935 million, according to the governor's office. Long term, they estimate the new facilities would save state taxpayers $34 million annually, while negating the need to repair hundreds of millions worth of deferred maintenance at the existing facilities. The plan comes after a report from an outside consultant commissioned by the Illinois Department of Corrections to develop a master plan for the state's correctional facilities concluded last year that Logan, Stateville, and Pontiac were getting to the point of being inoperable. Of the $2.5 billion in deferred maintenance at the IDOC facilities, the report from Miami-based OCGL identified $286 million at Stateville and $116 million at Logan. If left unaddressed, those numbers would likely double in 5 years, the report said. Logan Correctional Facility, which originally opened in the 1870s as the Illinois Asylum for Feeble-Minded Children, before it started to be used as a prison in 1978, is a multi-level women's facility consisting of 57 buildings on 150 acres. Its inmate population was 1,070 as of June 2023, according to the IDOC data. The facility is one of two in the state, along with Decatur, that houses female inmates. Stateville Correctional Center, opened in 1925, is a maximum security men's facility with an inmate population of 1,926 as of June 2023. According to the CGL report, the average building condition index, that's a tool used to gauge the physical condition of a structure, was lowest at Stateville with a score of 57, and Logan 61, and Pontiac 66. This indicates moderate to significant degradation in need of repairs. Most of the state's other correctional facilities achieve scores in the 80s. The report found Logan to be inefficient, ineffective, and unsuitable for any population, adding that, quote, IDOC should find a more suitable location for housing its incarcerated women, end quote. Though the poor condition of the facilities is not in doubt, the administration's announcement leaves more questions than answers. Chief among them is where to relocate the female prison population currently housed at Logan if they are unable to stay during a construction of a new facility. It was suggested in the consultant's report that the minimum security and some of the medium security population could be transferred to Decatur. The consultant acknowledged, however, that there are no easy solutions for the maximum security population and those with special needs, such as those dealing with mental health issues. The only solution may be to relocate them temporarily to a men's facility. AFSCME said location poses logistical and safety concerns. The union also questioned what would happen to those employed at Logan and Stateville. Though many of them would likely be offered positions at other facilities, it's uncertain how far they would have to travel to take those positions. Lynch said the union cannot support this plan unless and until the department provides satisfactory answers to those compelling questions. The plan did win praise from the John Howard Association, an independent watchdog group that provides oversight of the state's correctional facilities and advocates for reforms, which called it, quote, an important step towards respecting the dignity and rights of people who are incarcerated. They noted, however, that Illinois prisons are under capacity, and the state can and should permanently close some of its worst prisons. Illinois prison population has decreased significantly in recent years, going from nearly 50,000 in 2013 to just under 30,000 now. Some of that decrease may be a short-term consequence of the COVID-19 pandemic. But a series of criminal justice reforms enacted by Pritzker and state lawmakers in recent years will likely reduce incarceration over the long term. The closure or repurposing of correctional facilities can be a politically fraught topic. They often serve as anchors in their often rural downstate communities, providing good-paying jobs and indirectly supporting the local economy. But changes to the state's corrections framework have already been taking place around the edges. In 2022, IDOC shuttered the medium security unit and the east and west cell houses of Pontiac Correctional Center, significantly reducing that facility's operational capacity. That same year, 10 buildings at Vandalia Correctional Center closed, cutting capacity by more than half. Design and build-out of the new Logan and Stateville facilities is expected to take 3 to 5 years. Since it's part of the governor's budget proposal, the plan would require approval from the state legislature. Carol?
And also from local pages here, we have an article about a man who shot his father to death is sentenced. A Clinton man who shot his father to death in December has been sentenced to 30 years in prison. Marquise Denier Winston, 33, was arrested December 31st and admitted that he unintentionally caused the death of his father, 50-year-old James McKinley Douglas, Jr. According to Clinton County District Court documents, Winston said he accidentally discharged a gun that he illegally had in his possession. The bullet struck Douglas in the chest. Douglas was taken to Mercy One Clinton Medical Center, where he died of his wound. Clinton County prosecutors initially charged Winston with first-degree murder. That charge was dropped after Winston pleaded guilty to the lesser included charge of involuntary manslaughter as a habitual offender and possession of a firearm by a felon as a habitual offender during a hearing February 3rd in district court. Each of the charges carries a maximum of 15 years in prison, with a mandatory minimum of 3 years on each count. During a sentencing hearing Thursday, Clinton County District Court Judge Patrick McElsey sentenced Winston to the maximum of 15 years on each count, with the sentences running consecutively or back-to-back. Winston will have to serve a mandatory minimum of 3 years on each count, or 6 years total, before he will be eligible for parole. At the time of the shooting, Winston was on parole in Clinton County until September 18, 2027, according to the Iowa Department of Corrections website. He was given a 10-year sentence in 2017 on a burglary charge and a 10-year sentence in 2020 on a charge of possession with the intent to deliver less than 5 grams of meth. He was released from prison and placed on work release on March 9, 2022. He was placed on parole in August 1, 2022. Jeff, back to you.
Iowa's revenue is projected to dip this year before a slight uptick in 2025. Iowa's tax receipts will come in slightly lower than expected this year, but revenues will hold steady in 2025, according to latest projections from a state panel that estimates the state's total revenue. The projections are critical as state lawmakers begin the work of crafting a budget for the upcoming fiscal year, using the projections by the Revenue Estimating Conference to determine how much they can spend. Income tax cuts for individuals and corporations will continue to drive down revenue from those sources, but state officials expect increasing consumer spending to increase revenues from sales tax. The panel, which met on Friday, expects Iowa's total revenue to be $9.63 billion this year, a decrease of about $219 million from last year and about $120 million lower than the state officials estimated in December. In fiscal year 2025, which begins July 1st, revenue is expected to reach $9.7 billion, an increase of about 0.7% from 2024. That number would be down about $100 million from 2022, when lawmakers enacted income tax cuts that put Iowa on a path to a flat 3.9% tax rate in 2026. State lawmakers will need to use the panel's last projection from December when deciding how to spend the state's tax dollars, because state law requires the lower of the two estimates to be used to create the budget. The 2025 estimate in December was $9.64 billion. Iowa Department of Management Director Ken Craig Paulson, who sits on the estimating board, representing the governor's office, said conservative spending by the Republican-led state government has put Iowa in a strong financial position. Paulson said there's room to further cut taxes, which Iowa's Republican leaders have all called for. Time for the obituaries. Here's Carol.
And we have today two obituaries and two funerals pending. I will begin with the funerals pending. The first is for Ernestine Jones, 79, of Rock Island, who passed away Saturday, March 16th, 2024, at her home. Arrangements are pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island. Patricia Kurtz, 72, of Davenport, Iowa, passed away Friday, March 15th, 2024, in Davenport. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial in Moline. For the obituaries, the first is for Carolyn K. Preece, that's P-R-I-E-S, born January 29th, 1943, and passed March 11th, 2024. Carolyn K. Preece, 81, of Ottawa, passed away Monday, March 11th, 2024, at Pleasant View Nursing Home in Ottawa. Funeral services will be at noon on Saturday, March 23rd, 2024, at Mueller Funeral Home in Ottawa, with Reverend Dwayne Kaufman officiating. Burial will follow at Davenport Memorial Park in Davenport, Iowa. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. until the time of service at the funeral home. Carolyn was born on January 29, 1943, to Odell, Illinois, to Maurice and Elizabeth Carolyn Gall Coffey. She graduated from Illinois State University with a bachelor's and master's degree in education. She worked as a kindergarten teacher in Harding, Illinois for 32 years. Carolyn married Walter Preece on February 9, 2001, in Chandler, Arizona. She enjoyed working with young children, traveling, casinos, and playing golf. She is survived by her husband, Walter Preece of Ottawa, two children, Kyle Decker of Centralia, Kelly Wheeler of Colorado, and a grandson, Cameron Decker of Farragut, Tennessee. She was preceded in death by her parents, Maurice and Elizabeth Coffey, and a sister, Judith Kurtz, on December 8, 2022. Memorials may be directed to the family. You may sign the online guest book and share remembrances at www.muellerf.com. Mueller Funeral Home and Crematory, 800 First Avenue, Ottawa, Illinois. The telephone number is, the zip code for that is 61350. Telephone number is 815-434-4433. And our final obituaries for Eddie Helton. Mr. Eddie Helton, 72, Brooksville, Mississippi, passed away Sunday, March 10th, 2024, UMMC, Jackson, Mississippi. A memorial service with military honors is planned for Saturday, March 23rd, 2024, at 3 p.m. at Cogrell Funeral Home in Macon, Mississippi. Memorials may be made to Sweet Paws Rescue at 310 Main Street in Groveland, Maine, Massachusetts, that's MA, 01834. Cockrell Funeral Home is honored to be entrusted with arrangements. Eddie's survivors include his wife, Diana Helton, son Jerry Russell Helton III of Tucson, Arizona, sister Melody Getz Rice of Mount Bethel, Pennsylvania, four grandchildren, Julia McKeegan, Tyler McKeegan, Dennis McKeegan, and Kenny Lee McCormick. Jeff?
Here's an obituary story that may be of interest to our readers. American pianist Byron Janis dies at 95. He was a composer, cultural ambassador that broke Cold War barriers. Byron Janis, a renowned American concert pianist and composer who broke barriers as a Cold War-era culture ambassador and later overcame severe arthritis that nearly robbed him of his playing abilities, has died. He was 95. Janis passed away on Thursday evening at a hospital in New York City, according to his wife, Maria Cooper Janis. In a statement, she described her husband as an exceptional human being who took his talents to their highest pinnacle. A childhood prodigy who studied under Vladimir Horowitz, Jonas emerged in the late 1940s as one of the most celebrated virtuosos of a new generation of talented American pianists. In 1960, he was selected as the first musician to tour the then Soviet Union as part of a cultural exchange program organized by the U.S. State Department. His recitals of Chopin and Mozart awed Russian audiences and were described by the New York Times as helping to break the musical Iron Curtain. 7 years later, while visiting a friend in France, Jonas discovered a pair of long-lost Chopin scores in a trunk of old clothing. He performed the waltzes frequently over the ensuing years, eventually releasing a widely hailed compilation featuring those performances. But his storied career, which spanned more than 8 decades, was also marked by physical adversity, including a freak childhood accident that left his left pinky permanently numb and convinced doctors he would never play again. He suffered an even greater setback as an adult. At age 45, he was diagnosed with a severe form of psoriatic arthritis in his hands and wrists. Jonas kept the condition secret for over a decade, often playing through excruciating pain. Jonas later told the Chicago Tribune, "It was a life and death struggle for me every day for years. At every point, I thought of not being able to continue performing, and it terrified me. Music, after all, was my life, my world, my passion." He revealed his diagnosis publicly in 1985 following a performance at the Reagan White House, where he was announced as a spokesperson for the Arthritis Foundation. The condition required multiple surgeries and temporarily slowed his career. However, he was able to resume performing after making adjustments to his playing technique that eased pressure on his swollen fingers. Jonas remained active in his later years, composing scores for television shows and musicals while putting out a series of unreleased live performances. His wife, Cooper Jonas, said her husband continued to create music until his final days. In spite of adverse physical challenges throughout his career, he overcame them and did not diminish his artistry, she added. "Music is Byron's soul, not a ticket to stardom, and his passion for and love of creating music informed every day of his life for 95 years. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And moving to the opinion page, that is about life and death. It's entitled Deciding When to Die, and there is a drawing here of an elderly person in a wheelchair with a bottle of fluid hanging there on the back, going down the path, and the path is just one until all of a sudden it splits, and one path goes to a sign that's called life, and the other path goes to death. And, of course, it's two different opinions here, deciding when to die. The first is written by Nilsa Centeno and Susie Flack. Centeno lives in Sidra, Puerto Rico, and Flack lives in Naperville, Illinois. They wrote this for the Chicago Tribune. We are two moms whose only sons, Miguel Casaquilo and Andrew Flack, lived in Illinois and died young from cancer. Our boys, both in their 30s, made emotional videos pleading to die peacefully from aggressive cancers. As similar as our two stories are, our sons experienced very different deaths. One suffered horribly before his death from brain cancer because Illinois did not have the option of medical aid in dying to end his intolerable suffering. The other died gently in California, surrounded by loved ones because he was able to choose medical aid in dying in that state, an end-of-life care option unavailable in Illinois. Despite the painful memories, We are carrying on our son's legacies by urging Illinois lawmakers to pass the recently introduced Illinois End-of-Life Options for Terminally Ill Patients Act. The bill would allow mentally capable, terminally ill adults in Illinois with 6 months or less to live the option to obtain prescription medication they can decide to take for a peaceful death. In 2012, at age 31, Mogolito was realizing his dream as a chef at Pettorino's restaurant in Chicago when doctors diagnosed him with an aggressive brain tumor. Despite Miguel's bravely enduring excruciatingly painful treatments, the cancer spread throughout his body. Miguel moved from Chicago back to his family's home in Puerto Rico. During his last weeks of life, Miguel recorded videos in English and Spanish to urge fellow Latinos to support medical aid in dying legislation nationwide. As a special education teacher in San Diego, Andrew, known as Drew, spent his last months of life advocating for medical aid in dying in his home state of Illinois through his blog and podcast. In August of 2017, Drew underwent tests because he was not feeling well. His mother dropped to the floor devastated when Drew called to say it was cancer. For 2 years, Drew underwent radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery, but the painful treatments failed to cure the cancer. In December 2020, doctors told Drew his cancer was terminal, and he decided to stay in California because he wanted to access the state's End of Life Option Act that allows medical aid in dying. One died in peace, other in pain. On November 16, 2022, Drew was in his bedroom with its stunning view of the setting sun, with Jackson, his roommate's dog. Everyone commented on the beauty of the skyline, sharing funny stories from Drew's childhood, and Drew got everyone laughing in turn. Two hospice nurses mixed the medication with juice, and they gave Drew a spoonful of raspberry sorbet to take it with. Within 2 hours, he fell asleep and passed away peacefully. Miguel's morphine patch did nothing to alleviate the severe headaches, back pain, and electric shocks throughout his body. He died experiencing extreme suffering. His mother felt as if she failed her sacred duty to protect her only son. As grieving Catholic mothers, we firmly believe this option at the end of life does not take God's will away. God is kind and compassionate, and he does not want his children to suffer. We are proud to continue our late son's work. We are grateful that 10 states and the District of Columbia now allow terminally ill adults to choose medical aid in dying. More than 70% of Illinois voters support the option, according to a February 2023 survey conducted by Impact Research. We invite you to honor our son's memory and to tell your elected representatives that it is time for them to allow this gentle dying option. Will you join us? Now we'll go for the other opinion to Jeff.
Assisted suicide is not medical care. This opinion authored by Dr. Errol Baptist, who is a pediatrician in private practice in Rockford and a clinical professor of pediatrics at the University of Illinois College of Medicine at Rockford. I have practiced medicine in the U.S. as a pediatrician and in a developing country as a family physician, caring for patients from birth to old age. As a patient, I have experienced excruciating pain. I've survived cancer, undergone major surgery, and brought these experiences to bear in my role as physician and healer. At many bedsides, I've seen those same life experiences through the eyes of critically ill people fighting for their lives, who are in pain and in distress. And in several shocking instances, they are in distress caused by family whose sole support was defined by a desire for the family member to die and trigger whatever windfall awaits. In medical school, we are taught to do no harm and that all patients are to be treated equally. We are taught we must do all we can to relieve symptoms, to give comfort, and to care to all patients and their families. The Hippocratic Oath, as written 2,400 to 2,600 years ago, included the admonition, quote, "I will neither give a deadly drug to anybody if asked for it, nor will I make a suggestion to this effect," end quote. It was honored and affirmed by the medical profession for centuries. Death is not a symptom nor a cure. It is the enemy physicians and patients agree to fight together. Whether it's called assisted suicide, physician-assisted death, or some other name that masks its eugenics-like nature, it is wrong. It is engaging in the process to determine how to kill a patient. This enterprise is not the role and calling of a physician or any other medical professional under ethical medicine. Assisted suicide is a final solution to the problem of pain that doesn't exist, given the advances in medicine and particularly in palliative care. As an example, one man who was about 70 years old, he was severely dehydrated and in pain. His family was visibly angry and said he was too old and pleaded, "So please let him die." In a timely manner, treatable problems were solved, and the family's loved one was ready to return home. This time, the family was hostile. Our perceptive nursing staff intervened and informed me that his relatives had been emphasizing that they were there to receive their inheritance. In another equally disturbing incident, one of our team members walked out saying he was not going to have anything to do with this blank. This blank was a disabled man who had been admitted to the hospital for pneumonia. "He needs to die," the team member said. But what the patient needed was antibiotics, to which he responded promptly. Because of the antibiotics, he survived a few weeks longer. His family made an appointment to meet me after he passed. They thanked me because the extra time they had with him brought their contentious family together. This healed him in a way no antibiotic could. Another person had terminal cancer and was in pain. The chemotherapy stopped, but her care went on. Our team relieved her pain, and this young girl survived much longer than the specialist initially estimated. The family and this young girl were profoundly grateful for her extended time. When her time came to go, she quietly slipped away while in the arms of her loved ones. In each instance, the primary need of the person was to heal and to be provided comfort and extension of life. What is plainly obvious is that assisted suicide is a solution to a problem that does not exist. In a just society, a member of the disability community should not be pressured into believing that autonomy means choosing death over life. For years now, advances in palliative care, in hospice and medicine writ large, have left assisted suicide and its ableist aims in the eugenic dustbin of history. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And now we'll go to the sports pages. Iowa girls prep basketball, the Muscatine Muskies. Muscatine is one of only three Iowa schools with multiple players in Monday's Iowa-Illinois All-Star basketball game, featuring the top seniors from the Quad Cities region. Briley Seaman and Annie Zillig will represent the Muskies at Augustana College's Carver Center in Rock Island in the girls' game at 6 p.m. The seniors' duo combined to average 27.6 PPG, 12.4 RPG, and 32.2 SPG this season for Muscatine, which finished with an 11-11 record, their most wins since 2019. Zillig said, "I'm really excited to participate in the All-Star game. I was not expecting it. I thought my last game was our last regional game. But it's really exciting to play one more game with Briley, too. I think we both worked really hard this year, so it's kind of good to see your hard work pay off playing in an all-star game. Seaman had similar sentiments. Seaman said, I'm very excited to play with new people. I've always liked meeting new people, playing with new people, and I think it would be fun to get back playing again. We haven't played in a while, so I think it's going to be a great time. The senior duo will be playing among the likes of Assumption's Maddie Nigge and Pleasant Valley's Jesse Clemens, who both were named to the All-MAC first team. The other Iowa schools with multiple players on the team are Davenport Assumption. That's Maddie Nigge, Lexi Hayes, and Davenport North's Kyra Taylor and Michaela Farnham. Seaman said of playing opponents turned teammates, I always think it's super fun. We always talk about the season and what it's like playing against each other, and then we'll talk about what it's like playing now with each other. I think it's really cool to see that happen. Zelig agreed and is also excited about that opportunity. Zelig said, it's kind of fun to play with them now compared to playing against them. I think it will be fun. Seaman and Zelig have been playing basketball together since elementary school. Zelig recalled, we have played together since about fourth or fifth grade. We played AAU basketball for a while. Seaman has embraced that decade-long relationship between the two, saying, Andy and I have played for as long as I can remember. Our connection on the court and off the court is better than what I could ever have imagined. We know how each other plays. We know how to pick each other up. And we know how to talk to each other when one might not be in a game or when we're doing well. And when we connect like that, the game is much better and much smoother. As for the next level, the two will be taking separate paths. Seaman will be attending the Wartburg College in the fall, playing basketball collegiately, but is undecided on her major. She said, I'm very excited to start something new in a different community, but I know that comes with nerves, and definitely moving out is definitely pretty scary. But I think the coaches in the past years have definitely helped me and trained me to be where I am today. I give all my credit to them. Zelig will be attending the University of Nebraska, focusing on a pre-med track as a possible pediatrician. She said, I really enjoy working with kids. I want to go more a pediatrician track, but I also just enjoy learning about that kind of stuff. I think the medical field is really inspiring to me, and I kind of had a love for it. The Muskies under first-year head coach Courtney Jones finished with their best record since 2020. She said, it's definitely an adjustment having a new coach, but I think, us seniors really guided the younger kids to help us at the end of the season. It was a good year, and I definitely think that you could see the improvements over the course of the season. I thought this season was really good compared to our season before. We won 11 games this year, Zelig said. Last year we won only 3. Jeff, to you.
Hoops in the Heartland, Drake 76, Missouri State 75, as Miller lifts Drake to the title. A buzzer beater sends the Bulldogs to the NCAA tournament. Missouri State University women's basketball team was like a really annoying mosquito on Sunday afternoon for the Drake Bulldogs. No matter how large a lead top-seeded Drake opened, the third-seeded Lady Bears kept fighting back, and that made for quite an entertaining championship game in the Missouri Valley Conference Hoops in the Heartland, gathering at Vibrant Arena at the Mark. With the two teams battling for all 40 minutes, the game was finally decided on the final two shots, the last being Anna Miller's fadeaway push shot from the lane, and the final horn sounded to give the Bulldogs a 76-75 victory and a repeat conference championship. I'm just shocked, said Miller during the team's on-court celebration. I knew the ball was going to go in no matter who shot it. It just happened to be me, and it went in. Despite opening double-digit leads throughout the contest and leading for 38 minutes and 46 seconds, Drake needed a final prayer to be answered in order to win its 14th straight game, claim its second straight Hoops in the Heartland title, and secure the school's second straight automatic berth into the NCAA tournament that starts later this week. Lacey Stokes had just given Missouri State its first and only lead of the game with 2.6 seconds left when she hit a running floater just outside the lane at the right side and she capped her 16-point outing. Drake took a timeout, advanced the ball up to its front court, and set up an out-of-bounds play right in front of its bench. Miller, who hit 11 of 12 field goal attempts in the game and finished with a game-high 25 points to go with a team-high 7 rebounds, admitted that the play didn't unfold exactly how it was drawn up in the huddle. "We had a few wrinkles off of it," admitted Drake coach Allison Pullman afterwards. Taylor McCauley triggered the play that was designed to find MVC Player of the Year Katie Dinebeer up top, but instead gave it to Courtney Becker in the near corner. Becker made a move toward the baseline, fed Miller in the lane, and the 6'3" junior took one dribble to her left across the lane as she was fading away, pushed the ball up to the rim. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.